Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the Podcast, the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. I'm joined by co-host Terry Robinson. And in our last episode, Terry and I were looking at Dark Ages Mage, and Terry and I were saying, you know, the Dark Ages is so interesting. Wouldn't it be nice to just stay a while? So we found a cottage that was being let cheap, and we decided to spend a little more time in the Dark Ages. I mean, who wouldn't want to? Well, yeah, actually, okay, maybe there's a few reasons. Okay, a few reasons why maybe you wouldn't
want
to.
Very clearly, when you get to the section where a mushroom does 10 minus your stamina in bashing damage, I'm like, oh, Nelly, I'll take the technocracy.
Okay, but putting that aside for a moment, we have decided to hang out a little more in the Dark Ages, and so we are going to bring you another book for that today on Tomes of Magic. We're going to look at Dark Ages Mage Grimoire, but before we do, Terry, are there any announcements?
I do have a note, and you mentioned we're going to stay a little bit more in Dark Ages. We are also going to cover a few of the non-line specific, I guess you could say, black border or generic Dark Ages book, including Devil's Due, which is about infernalism. Woo! More infernalism!
Yeah.
We are also going to cover excerpts from Darkening Sky, which is kind of a plot book, which is like, here's all the kooky stuff happening in 1230. Rite of Princes, which is like, ruling, it's hard, especially because of peasants. How do? And then I will probably use this as my excuse to talk with someone about Dark Ages Fae, the book that is interesting, but apparently in no way fits in with the rest of Changeling. I don't know. I haven't really read either. That's why I'm on a podcast and I talk to other people. But we're going to spend even more time in the Dark Ages. And hopefully by then, Victorian will be out, or fingers crossed, Guide to the Traditions, he said with a glimmer of dying hope in his eye. as of this recording, there are 39 books in art direction on the Onyx Path monthly update, and with each passing week, my soul grinds down a little bit, and I am a step closer to stepping into the calls. But that's all I have to say. How about you, Adam?
Well, speaking of the Dark Ages...
Speaking of the
Dark Ages... Terry, I think you're in the right mindset to just roll right into the Dark Ages, so... But we are looking at Dark Ages Grimoire. This book was put out in 2003. There were 8 authors contributing to this book, which clocks in at 160 pages. And I have the big question of the episode right up front. Terry, with your obscure and profound knowledge of the world of darkness and Mage in particular, I was hoping you could answer a question that has been on my mind for a week now. On the front and back covers of this book, we have stylized letters that read out Grimoire, and the second R is backwards, and the E has a tail on it. What's going on there?
I will tell you what is going on there. That is the work of one Richard Thomas and one Michael William Kaluta. The thing that throws me off about this book is it uses the artwork of William Kaluta. We had that in 1E. That's how we got all the 1E and 2E tradition book covers, but he is kind of a dynamo of artistic production when it comes to Mage the Awakening, which is but 2 years away. So I'm going to assume that these are letters that come from the supernal realm that have fallen through, incurred paradox from the abyss, and landed on this book. The other way you can tell that there is paradox taint is it uses that slight glowing text background thing, which everyone thought looked good, but was actually just a one-point paradox flaw that all of these book covers incurred. And that is my answer to that, because anyone who spent more than 10 minutes dealing with desktop publishing knows that that background glow is kind of dumb.
Well, another mystery solved on Mage the Podcast. That's why you come back for each episode. I was wondering about that, though. It's like, I guess that's kind of cool, but kind of weird. I wonder what's going on here. But now I have a little insight. So,
a completely wrong answer that no one will believe.
Well, this book has 5 chapters and an appendix, and it is a general purpose companion to Dark Ages Mage, which is something I'm very thankful for. So, Terry, can you start us off with a walkthrough?
I will be glad to. As I was walking through, a few titles struck my fancy. One was Dark Ages Grimoire, If the Xenophobia Doesn't Kill You, the Tainted Food Will. The second is The Big Book of Pillars, I'm Not Quite Sure About. And the third one is William Kaluta, Where the Dink Have You Been? But that brings us into the prelude, which tells us, How long are we going to be crossing a desert? Very long. To Egypt. But there's water. But now there are brigands. No, you stole my book. And to the best of my understanding, that is kind of the plot that is carried out through the rest of the little fictional pieces as a Bettini mage deals with the dumbest Messianic Voices character I have ever met, who is like, well, yeah, we have magic, but how are we going to get from here to there quickly? With magic. Oh, I would have never thought of that. Thank the Lord. And I'm like, buddy, we're going to be, yeah, I'm just, some people consider intelligence a dump stat. That brings us into the introduction where we get a quote from Wikipedia in 2003. And I'm like, oh man, this book is so old. Wikipedia was on the vanguard of something. The introduction itself holds a little bit more information on the fellowships and how they work, and then information on superstitions and the other worlds and how to storytell. And it's okay. So it's the original book, but with four more chapters on five of its chapters. So I put on my big boy reading pants and I dove in to chapter one, which is entitled The Sons of Solomon, Civilized Fellowships. And every time I see a reference to Solomon, I shed a single tear because we do not have information on the Toftani of this era, and the Ali Bettine get to be the masters of the Jinn. Bettini society is shown as being under some sort of test, and the Murshid masters seem unconcerned. This is a view that kind of what is happening to the societies that the Bettini kind of look over is kind of a grand test. The Crusades were allowed to happen to get rid of the sense of invulnerability that had crept into the Muslim world, which really sounds like some second level, like Xanatos Gambit level stuff where it's like, no, I wanted you to destroy my orphan-powered space laser. That was all part of my evil plan. Mwahaha. I'm more powerful than ever. You just got hit in the face by the Christians. I don't think this was part of your master plan as they nearly destroy the web of faith, but sure. They mention that the Christian presence in the Holy Land is welcome for the change that it brought, and they view it as a kind of cultural exchange. Again, there's a lot of stabbing in the Bettini definition of cultural exchange. They were glad to see the fall of the Byzantine Empire, which allowed for the expansion of Islam, and now they're realizing that the Mongols are a big threat. No dink. The leadership spends a lot of its time on Mount Kaf, or Jabal Kaf, as it is addressed in the realm of similitudes, or Alam al-Mithral, which I thought was an interesting idea. It is the furthest north point, and it surrounds the world, which seems hard to have both of those true at the same time. But hey, if that's the correspondence point, sure. It is the place where the mental transmissions that the Kutubs send back and forth, and it is located in the umbra of the Middle East somewhere. So we're now up to like five different locations that it could be in, which I'm fine with, in the same way that there are three different places the City of Brass could be. We then get kind of a tour of what is happening in the Bettini world. And in Europe, at least, it focuses on Spain, and that in Al-Andalus, in Spain, the great mosque of Cordoba is the center of activity. The advance of Christianity is moving the center of activity further south towards Granada. It talks about how the Silk Road is moving goods through Europe. This is a point of dissemination, and things like Kabbalist lore are making their way out from here. We learn that they have a group of insurgent sex spies noted for their polyglot nature and fair skin. And I'm like, oh, that's... Just that whole sentence kind of makes me a little uncomfortable. They seem to be dealing with a mounting success, and in the context of talking about insurgent sex spies, the phrase mounting success is ambiguous to me. We then get some character descriptions for some people with no stats, including a guy that does umber stuff, a guy that does court stuff, and a really strong magic guy. We then get a reminder of what the schools are. These seem largely unchanged from what we got in Lost Paths, or more accurately, if Lost Paths came out later, they seem largely unchanged from here. We have the Scholastic University of Life. We have the Silk Cartel, which does trade, the Paradise Garden, which is politically powerful, the Ikhwan al-Tawhid, which is members mostly in seclusion, the Darwushim, who are beggars that live in the moment, and some information kind of about how they're organized, that the rank of murid, you gain significant influence, and the murshids choose a member from their group to be a kutub or an axis that connects them to the other groups, also called kanakas. Their magic work is subtle, involving mirrors, water reflections, math texts as being its few cornerstones. We get some rotes, and this is kind of a formula we will get for all the sections. One that lets you remember everything. One that lets you jump from pot to pot like their pipes in Mario. And we also get information on the Seal of Solomon and a list of spirits tied to that. Take that, Toftani. I found this section remarkably hard to follow. There is no glossary, so I hope you remember everything from the core book. Gives you recommendations on how to blend into Europe, like being part of a traveling troupe, being part of an assassin team, and that many people in the Crusades pick up a new way of thinking. Again, it reminds you that the real enemy is prejudiced, and if you don't play it to the hilt, you're playing this game with that it also includes gin and unicorns wrong. The next section is on the messianic voices, many faces of one faith, and this further intensified my utter confusion as to what the messianic voices of this era is. The Catholic portion is clearly the most powerful. Those who work with the messianic voices within the Catholic hierarchy will also gain a fair amount of temporal power. It has strong ties to the Holy See, which is to say the Vatican or the Church in Rome. We then get some tension as to how non-Catholics are treated, as in one part it's like, there's a bunch. And another part that's like, if you're not Catholic, you're screwed. We learn about the Beguine movement, which is a set of female ascetics and philanthropic practitioners in the Netherlands. That was new to me. Good and neat. Learn. We also learn about Desiderius of Rome, the Pontifex Maximus, and I think the only Pontifex Maximus, the only like fellowship head that we learn about, who sees the church as being for commoners and the messianic voices being for mages, which is a thing that was kind of an idea of the Celestial Chorus in 1E, may have another identity within the church. We get information on 5 of the 17 members of the Curia, which is kind of the governing group of the messianic voices. We learn that the Shadow Inquisition exists in the Holy See and that no member of a fellowship was invited to join. The pontifex knew about this and kind of dismissed it. We get advice to show both war and faith at their extremes with good and bad voices and good and bad barbarians. Similarly, their voices aren't above using commoners to take out their dislike of someone else or to declare a heresy. And then we get some information on heretical movements as well as kind of a brief overview of what is happening in different places. We get a mention of the Gabrielites or the Gavrielites, who seek to use the fire of reason to cleanse things. We get information on the Cathars of Albi in France, and after the destruction, people are like, not cool. There are whispers of democracy in the Holy Roman Empire, and then we get some information on heretical movements. We get Catharism, we get information about the Eastern Church. This section has a few little niggling scholastic errors in it that didn't quite fit with me. Like at this point, the Western Church does not really have a doctrine of papal infallibility unless you kind of do an odd interpretation of some of the doctrines of earlier Pope Gregory or kind of misread certain things that came out of the Lateran Council and so on. We get some information about Gnosticism, which is a set of beliefs about there being some secret wisdom that can unite one with God. They mention the Hermetics and the Mandeans as practitioners. Give me information on the Mandeans. We need them in Mage. We have information on the Attonites, which is the first monotheistic believers within the Chorus who followed Aton, the sun god of Egypt. And now, as a note, as a person with solar panels on my house, sun worship is really making sense to me right now, so I may have to do more investigation into that. This was kind of an idea that the citizens would worship the pharaoh and the pharaoh would pass on the worship to Aton. We get information about how the Jewish voices seem to enmesh themselves in their community more so than dedicating themselves to holiness, which puts them at odds with everyone else. Everyone is confused by their lack of hierarchy. And there's a line where they say they believe the simple truths of Christianity are base. And I'm like, Christianity's simple and dumb, which I thought was kind of neat. We get an aside on Mithraism, a warrior cult of action that excluded women and the non-martial, eventually was outcompeted. There is an aside which I think is a reference to the fourth generation Ventru vampire Mithras, who is the recently awakened Prince of London, I think. We also get obligatory information about Zoroastrianism and the embrace of virtues of good mind, righteousness, devotion, dominion, wholeness, and immortality. They are embodied in the Amesius Spentas or the Boundless Immortals. And again, it kind of goes through this very quickly. Indicates that the Sufis or mystically inclined practitioners of Islam tend to join the Batini, whereas those that have a less ecstatic approach tend to join the Messianic voices. This seems like a big deal that you would want to talk about, the kind of split within Islam potentially and who goes where. The internal tensions of the messianic voices to me are not dealt with in this section. The impression that I get is that Roman Catholics are dominant in the organizations, but there are other groups that are dominant in other areas, and they seem to be more concerned about heresies within Catholicism than they are necessarily about different organizations. So if you are a Jewish chorister, you will likely not advance highly, but you probably won't be as actively persecuted as if you are a messianic voice who disagrees with the Nestorian heresy or some other point of dogma. But that's just a guess. I just don't know enough coming out of this section. The last part of this chapter is the Order of Hermes, many houses, one law. So now the order has recognized other fellowships as being legitimate practitioners of magic. There is a movement to dissolve the Hermetic houses and to create a more unified Hermetic front. Others strongly disagree with this. We get a quick view of the houses of the era: Boni Sagis, Ex Miscellanea, Flambeau, Quaesator, Titulus, and Verditius. And we don't get a bunch of new information, but we do get a little bit on their personality, like Titulus wanting to conquer the world and being the generals of the order, and growth coming from conflict, which we had seen before. We get information about how it's a lonely lot to be a quaesator, which again is not new. We do get some information about recruiting, which basically says that 1 in 15 quaesators will actually finish it. And likewise with the Titulans, have only 1 in 6 that go through. So this is another group where they're awesome at weeding things out. We get a little bit of information about where they're located in the world. My favorite note here is they say that France is the center of activity for the Hermetics. So not only is the Order of Hermes full of assholes, it is full of French assholes.
Ouch.
Yeah. In the Holy Roman Empire, we get the line that says, every chantry within a day's ride of Vienna has fallen to the Tremere and its adaptable magic. One, I thought the whole idea of vampire magic was that it was not adaptable. The other thing was, a day's ride is about 25 miles. That's really not a lot of the Holy Roman Empire. The Order of Reason is trying to deal with the switch of the Masasa War, which is the war with Tremere, from being one of outright warfare to being one of politicking and treachery, albeit one where your opponent cannot be awake during the day. Hamburg is kind of the center of their activity in the region. They're trying to expand in Spain while everyone else is seemingly busy. We get a little bit of information on Dewizitep, that it's roughly a mile square and contains 300 commoners. They are spending time in the Holy Land trying to tap the magical riches there. Accra hosts a large chantry in the Crusader States. I do like that it says we only spend time in places that are civilized. All these other places aren't, so take that. The order is suspicious. I could summarize most of this section with the idea that between 1 and 20 centuries ago, something bad happened to the order, and now the order is suspicious. We get an interesting note that Gil Ghul exists, but this is before anyone has a notion of an avatar, so I wonder in period what that is viewed as. This section had repeated information on what attributes were most common, and that really just felt like padding. It was often a paragraph or two, and it was a lot of things. There was like, this group that contains a lot of diplomats thinks that physical skills are important because nothing settles a diplomatic row like arm wrestling. And you're like, wait, what? Additionally, the lack of anyone having a pillar ranking felt like even the authors couldn't be bothered to pick up the magic system in some places. The plot arcs are very single character focused. Like, if my goal of my character is to like kill the embodiment of Lucifer, I'm not sure how I get other people that don't believe that very specific thing on board. Kind of the separateness and doctrinaire qualities of the fellowships at this time seemed like it would really spread to everyone else. This was a big chapter. It had a lot of in-world information. I just talked a lot. Apologies to everyone. Adam, what did you think about the first three fellowships?
Yeah, the first two chapters of this book are most of the book.
They are
very, very beefy, because chapter one takes three fellowships and chapter two takes the other three fellowships. And so it's just a lot of reading before you even see chapter three. I can understand Terry's point of view, saying that when the Crusades came to the Middle Eastern or the Holy Lands, that the Bettini were taking a beating. But from my, I guess you could say, first edition mage kind of point of view, I like to take the viewpoint that mages are not so directly identifying with a group of sleepers and like totally connected to them. I like the idea that mages say, look, we're mages, we're apart, we kind of stand in the shadows and observe from there. And so I found it very interesting, from my point of view, to have the Bettini mages look at the Crusades unfolding, and they're saying, okay, in the short term, you know, this is really terrible. People are dying, and it's causing a lot of destruction and damage, even to our faith web. But we are using our arts to look at the long view, and we're seeing a cultural exchange that will lead to unity in sleeper society in future eras. And so we don't just come down and say, hey, the Crusades are terrible, stop it all now, chase these foreigners away. They have this point of view of this hurts and it's bad, but the long-term benefits are worth enduring this for. And so I liked that idea. Also, I like the idea that in this time, in this place, you know, the sleepers are seeing these European foreigners come in and cause all this damage, and they're saying, wow, this is terrible. This is the real problem we've got to solve. And you have the Bettinis using their magical arts to look at the future, and they see these Mongol hordes way off in the distance. They're saying, no, the Mongols are the real problem. And that's what we really need to worry about, because these Europeans are, the damage that you see in front of you, it's nothing compared to what the Mongols are planning to do and for a much longer time. So I found that very, very interesting. And I would like, as a storyteller, I would like to look for opportunities to pull that into, you know, in character scenes if my players were to go to the Holy Lands in 1230. But moving on page 14, we see the formation of the Mamluks. These are a group, this was a real world group of soldiers. They were all male. They were captured from non-Middle Eastern people, but they were used by the Turks to become an elite army within an army of soldiers. And this is interesting for Mage, because these Mamluk soldiers in the World of Darkness in the future led to House Janissary, which was a house of the Order of Hermes. And there was so much metaplot that we got in first and second edition Mage books, even in 2004, the book Ascension, which was planned at the time to finish the revised edition line, that pulled in, you know, the fall of House Janissary and their charismatic leader that was so important. So it is interesting to see the beginning here in this book, and when we saw the end in the book titled Ascension. What I want to know about the Bettini is, do they believe unity can be forced on the masses, or can unity only be achieved by persuading the masses? This is a question that I actually expected to get an answer to reading chapter one, and I did not get that answer. So just, you know, as a Mage fan who wants to look at the Dark Ages Mage setting, this is something I actually want to know about the Bettini. We get a lot of great information on them, but the answer to that question would help me a lot as a storyteller. I really like the idea they have here of a person going to the, you know, umbral Mount Koff, and then starting at the bottom and hiking up towards the top, and in the process being challenged and gaining wisdom from that. This is not totally new. We did get some information about this in previous modern era mage books, but still, I like seeing this listed here, and I think a creative storyteller could really do a lot with that. This section on the Ali Bettin had great information on locations in Europe and also Bettini foci. So I thought that was very gameable material. I really enjoyed that. I felt like the author of this particular Bettini section was giving me what, as a storyteller, I need to have to run some games. So really appreciated that. The opposite opinion when I got into the Messianic Voices section, basically reading through the Messianic Voices section of chapter one, it seemed like the author said, I like writing about religions, so I'm going to write about religions. And I wouldn't be surprised if to this day, that author, whose name I don't know, I'll bet he doesn't even know he was writing for a role-playing game. I'll bet you could like catch him on the street and, you know, and say, you know what, Dark Ages Mage was a role-playing game. He's like, no, you're kidding me. But enough of that. One comment here, the six fellowships are covered in the first two chapters, and I was surprised by how different the formats of those six little sections were. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it would have been nice if the developer could have given more of a like general approach or a game plan, if you will, to each of these authors writing these six sections, so that the six sections had more in common. Because it's just not just the style, but I mean the type of information addressed in these six sections varies so wildly that it would have been nice to have more similarities than differences. But moving on to the Order of Hermes at the end of chapter one, I really enjoyed the description here of House Flambeau. House Flambeau, of course, is well known in many different editions of Mage, of being the house of the Order of Hermes that has the battle mages, the combat mages. They want to settle the conflict directly right now with their battle magics rather than being crafty or clever. In the past, I've seen write-ups of them that basically said, they're a bunch of meatheads and they start fights everywhere they go and they're always punching people. And it's like, okay, this seems a little simplistic. But here in chapter one of this book, we get a description of House Flambeau telling us that they are more considerate to commoners, or you could say sleepers, than other houses of Hermes. Sleepers find them more relatable than they do other hermetic mages. And I really like this. It gave me sort of a nice handle on this house of the Order of Hermes that I would like to bring into my games. Now, when I talked about House Titulus, I saw a repeat of information I've seen in past mage books, which I understand that House Titulus is all about growing through conflict, overcoming conflicts, or learning from conflicts where you fail. That's an interesting idea, but I think that the write-up we get in this book takes that a little too directly, a little too literally. It talks about how House Titulus mages are always torturing each other, always picking fights with other hermetics just so that they can pick a fight. And so I thought that a little more subtlety, a little more long-term view would have been appreciated. But great info on hermetic locations in Europe and the rest of the world. There were story hooks. There were details. It was just great. When I want gameable material, this is a perfect example of it. So hats off to the author of this section on the Order of Hermes. One thing that I just had to chuckle about, maybe I'm the only guy here, but there's a sidebar on page 57 that says, you may be reading through this section and thinking that the hermetics are arrogant to a fault. Well, they are. Okay, thank you, sidebar. Really, really doubling down on that arrogance just because I guess we need to do that.
Yeah, well, that one I kind of liked because it was like, no, this is actually the Order of Hermes at the height of their power. This is right before the Order of Reason kind of emerges. So it's nice to actually briefly see the period where it's like, no, right now they are the unchallenged masters of almost everything. Sucks to be them.
Okay, well, I guess from that point of view, I might be able to understand. I'm so accustomed to reading about the reading descriptions of the Order of Hermes in later eras where it says, they've lost almost everything, and they're so arrogant. It's like, how does that fit?
Yeah.
But anyway, so that pretty much wraps up my thoughts on chapter one. Let's dive into the beefy chapter two.
Oh, it's a chunk. These chapters are big enough that they're not allowed to sit on the same side of the plane. Otherwise, it's going to fly real weird. Chapter 2 is entitled, In a Dark Wood, Heathen Fellowships. We get some information on the Old Faith, the Keepers of the Flame, and we get the virtues of paganism, which is interesting because we also got the virtues of paganism in witches and pagans at the end of Sorcerer's Crusade. And there's a bunch of little cases where like these two rhyme, and they say that vitality, wanting to live life to its fullest and being out in the world, is a cardinal virtue, and that they don't wish to become a burden to others. So, I don't know, they take their supplements but also have a living will or something like that. Courage is important, the ability to do what needs to be done. All membership in the Old Faith involves some sort of courage. Honor, that trustworthy and dedication to a code of ethics is important, that your word is your bond, as well as generosity, to give towards the poor and unfortunate, and often this is expressed as treating a guest well. These virtues didn't feel particularly unique to the Old Faith. It seems like it would apply to a lot of people, but it's good. I think this is a section I would have loved to have had for every fellowship. That way you could all have them next to each other and kind of compare the two. We go through a bunch of the old gods, that there are certain archetypes that generally every character is going to have. The mother, the father, the sun, the moon, the storm, someone in charge of beasts, battle, healing, poetry, smith work, cunning, love, and some sort of triple god or goddess. We get some pagan practices, the honor price, that if a wrong is committed, some price needs to be paid, from something as simple as an apology to something more ruinous, that storytelling is important, that the Celts considered bards inviolate, and that their stories and their keepers held the culture. Sacrifice is being important. Gods want sacrifice so they can be fed. I don't think we ever really seal the deal on that notion of sacrifice, except for the Valdermin pillar and the notion that you can turn wound penalties into bonuses and so on, which is more about like self-injury to me necessarily than sacrifice. I don't think this book kind of landed that, we get the Wheel of the Year, which is a set of important dates that we got in Verbena Revised, which also came out this year, and both were likely done by Steve Kinson. So, hi, Steve. We get a smattering of groups that would be belonging to the old faith, that the Celts were destroyed by the Romans, who decimated them and burnt their sacred groves. We get the Striga of Italy that could place curses, although we get no pillar information really about what that is or how. And then the Baltics. Do you want details on what I mean by the Baltics? Well, too bad. This section doesn't have it for you. We then get a whole bunch of rotes. Boy, howdy, do these sections have rotes. Bitter fruit, which is a remarkably slow and ineffective way to poison someone and is actually significantly less deadly than the actual food that we get later in this book. It does one health point of damage a day that can be soaked. So, yeah, we get a spell to turn people into animals, but no information on how to resist it. We get Eternal Slumber, which requires 20 successes, 35 quintessence, and 4 points of temporary willpower. With Fount 5, you can only store 20 points. I literally don't know how you can even do this. We get Withering Curse, which is the same thing as Bitter Fruit, except for you get to soak with willpower. All is forgiven, as the next page is a beautiful piece of Quentin Hoover artwork that had brought a tear to my eye. Jeez, I love Quentin Hoover. We then get information on the Spirit Talkers, those outside. The Spirit Talkers are animistic and quirky, and it seems like they are very hard to play, as you need to be constantly doing odd and potentially disruptive things. If you're going to have this be that, I think I need a page of 30 examples of weird little things your character can do as a quirk, and it even includes a role-playing note that's like, if you're going to be a spirit talker, it's going to be kind of hard. And I'm like, ah, okay, finally, we have the Malkavians of Mage. We then get some information about the groups. It points to the Mongols as group to get more information on, and I was really excited to get more information about the Golden Horde, Tamanujin, what the practices are, and it's like, you should go read Mongols Winds from the East, which is not actually the title of a World of Darkness book. It is simply Winds from the East, which is a Dark Ages vampire thing, which probably will not include a lot of information on what mages are doing, what for being different lines and such. We get some information on the Finns, who have weird complicated rituals and a lot of spirits that I can't pronounce. There were a lot of diacritics in that section. It does seem like Finland is a spirit talker wonderland, which makes me more interested in Finland than I normally am. Welcome, future NATO member. We get information on the Norse, and it's like, not everyone is a Valdorman. Moving on. It also mentions that if you're from somewhere else, you're likely harassed. Again, the true ascension is the prejudice we face along the way. We get information on kind of the specialties, which I thought was interesting. The types of spirits you interact with and how. You may interact with ghosts and use them to gain knowledge and information. While the Valdormen raise the dead, you may be good at simply talking to the dead. Ancestor spirits can be a source of both information, and being possessed by them can allow you to gain great personal power, as well as nature spirit. And you may rename the pillars instead of chieftain. You may worship the sun instead of trickster. You may have the pillar of ferret. And I'm all in favor of introducing murder tubes into the magic of mage. Mentioned they tend to be persecuted. Conformity is what allows you to survive, and most people see spirits and devils as the same thing in the Christian world. You may have access to dream magic, which is useful but slow. I don't know why it's slow, but it says it's slow. The pillars are also restated along with other recommendations about what they can be tied to and some kind of further enumeration on what is included in each. We get a bunch of rotes again. One is Rat Command, which you can do more easily if you enter the dreams of rats or sleeping, apparently. A rote that prevents the werewolves from regaining rage, which kind of seems narts. Each section's listing of rotes kind of has a different templating. Like throughout the old faith, it always listed the foundation plus pillar that you rolled, but in the previous chapter it didn't. We also get the vital rote of Summon Horse, which is OP because you get a horse for each success. So as an extended rote, you could just be like, I have all the horses, your move now, Order of Reason, nascent craft masons. You may have a cannon, but I have 30 horses. The rotes in this section are kind of interesting. They seem a little bit fractured because the spirit talker paradigm, for lack of a better term, is less unified than a bunch of the other ones. Likewise with the old faith. So it seems like there just needs to be more rotes to be like, well, you're a person who deals with the dead and I'm a person who deals with nature spirits. We're not going to use the same rote to accomplish the same thing. And both of them are going to be listed here. We then get the Valdermen, Bleak Secrets. Christianity is seeping into their territory because unified religion will simplify rule, or at least that is the argument that missionaries are waging, which doesn't make sense because it seems like they were all kind of unified in their heathenisms beforehand, and Christianity is certainly pretty fractious. We learned that most Runesingers are doing it part-time, that they are also farmers and sailors, and most study is done over long winter nights. We also learn that those of the North that work with Seater are likely women and likely to be members of the Spirit Talkers. You may be a court magician. Awesome. This, like most things in Dark Ages, is great for a single character or NPC, but terrible for a group. And that you will be at the beck and call of your lord, and they will constantly be asking you to use your magic, which keeps your quintessence low. And if you ever fail, people will be like, pretty crappy wizard if you don't have the ability to extinguish the sun in a single gesture. Nerd. We are also told that, again, sacrifice is key, but we don't really get examples. We are further reminded that the real enemy is sexism, as anyone using runes will be mocked as being effeminate, which seems awfully bold because the next 7 pages of rotes are like, here's how to have an entire village burned down by you winking. Here's a spear that will cause your enemy to be stabbed in the chest, as well as their next 7 generations of descendants to be stabbed in the chest. And you're like, okay, and you're that's the guy you're mocking. That's a choice. Just saying, if someone held a gun to my head and they're like, don't move, I wouldn't be like, oh, you're using a gun. Who's pretty unmet? And then my wallet would be gone. They go over a bunch of different jobs that you can have and that you may use your magic to make the world more comfortable, to help you wander about, to ask the dead for service or advice, as well as there being shapeshifters and battle mages. I thought that section was pretty cool. And we get battle rotes, and after the battle rote section, we get additional killing people rotes, which is somehow different than battle rotes, but I'll take it. You can strike someone blind, but only if you cover a spear with very specific insults. We get direct strike, which requires 2 pillars so that your spear can get to your foe real fast and so that you can get to your foe real fast and that you can do multiple attacks. It just does a lot of damage, and sometimes I have no idea why multiple pillars are being used. The scorn pole, which sounds like a euphemism, is you can insult someone so good they become unlucky. Coming to the end of this chapter, I have no idea how to balance rotes even more so than an M20. I don't really have a notion of the success economy and what the game wants me to work. In some cases, you need several base successes and then each success beyond that will do something. In other cases, it's just the case that you figure it would be 1-to-1, but it's not. So I'm not sure what to do there. What did you think about this section, Adam?
Chapter 2 had a lot more sample spells. Call them rotes, but I mean, the core book calls them spells. But anyways, magic effects. Has a lot more magic effects than chapter 1. And I hate to say it, but on a mage podcast, I felt a little bit out of my depth because usually we're talking about mage books that use the sphere system. And I have, you know, extensive experience there as a player and as a storyteller. So when it talks about, you know, it can do this and it can't do that, I have, you know, just right away in my mind springs up all these ideas of, oh, I'd tweak it this way or I'd ignore this facet of it and I can, you know, make this work. But when it comes to all of these pillar spells, I don't have experience as a storyteller running Dark Ages mage. And so the pillar system, I don't know as well. So I kind of have to take it on faith that the author is describing something that can work in the game. I mean, I have a basic understanding of the levels of pillars and some of the rules involved, but is this a really good one or is this a really weak one? I have less of a grasp on that than in most mage books I'm reading through. Looking at chapter 2, we start off with the old faith. We get another talk about their virtues and how, you know, it's different from other people. It's kind of like this. I have to agree with Terry. The way they describe these virtues, it lines up so well with other people's virtues that I don't think it stands out all that well. In my reading of some books and legends and stuff from older European sources, what really stands out to me was the notion of generosity was more for pagan leaders than for pagan, you know, followers, you know, the poor, less important, less wealthy pagan members. I don't think it was as important for them. And also the generosity virtue among the early European pagans, it was really more about generosity towards your allies, your guests, and your kin, your family members, than it was towards the general public or towards the poor people in your community. It was a more focused generosity, because that generosity served a purpose. If you are giving nice gifts to your troops, then they will keep being your troops. If you treat your family well, then when they get together and intrigue against someone, it probably won't be against you, because they like you. The guests who stay in your house, you know, you might be a guest in their house. So it's just thinking about, you know, long term, when people stay at my place, if I treat them well, then when I go and stay at their place, they won't kill me in the middle of the night. So, I mean, there were reasons behind these notions of generosity for the leaders of the pagans. I mean, you weren't supposed to just be generous towards the poor people in your community, because it's like, they're not really my people. I mean, they're supposed to do what I say, and that's the end of it. Putting that aside, there were a lot of spells and elixirs in the Old Faith section, and I found this gameable and helpful. There was some information on the gods, which it was nice. I'm not sure how much I would actually use that in a game. I just wish there was some more of that great gameable material I saw for the Bettinis and the Hermetics. But moving on to the Spirit Talkers, the explanation of how Spirit Talkers behave oddly and how others react to their odd behavior, I thought was useful. As I was reading through this section, I was thinking, okay, this actually can hook into the different superstitions of the time that mages can actually make use of with bonuses to their magic. And so that was actually nice to see. I don't understand why this section ignores the well-established spirit talkers of Eastern Europe. I felt like that was a real gap in this section. Because in the core book, when it talks about the spirit talkers, it says, okay, we've got two general groups. In Western Europe, you know, they lay low, they keep to themselves, they don't have influence in their communities. But in Eastern Europe, I mean, they have open, you know, temples and shrines, and they're very influential, and they have more wealth and power. Great. Tell me about those guys. Oh, this section forgets about them. Yeah, it left me disappointed. This section takes too long to tell us that the four pillars of the Spirit Talkers can have different names. There's a section on dream magic, which, reading this part on dream magic, I really got the impression that there were certain legends and real-world stories from older Europe that the authors were reading and thinking, wouldn't it be nice to pull this into Mage? And so if you want to do that, this section on dream magic can help you, you know, add that flavorful part to Spirit Talker magic in your games. But if that isn't particularly appealing to you, then you shouldn't feel like you have to use this bit on dream magic. For using it, I would lower the difficulty rather than lower the pillar levels available to dream magic. I think dream magic might get a little out of hand there. I'd have to play test it to be certain, but it sounds like just lowering the difficulty instead would be a better approach to dream magic. There's a spell for, not a dream spell, but for Spirit Talkers called Banish Spirits of War, and this is basically, you banish or send away all of the spirits in your immediate area that have to do with anger or warfare, battle, something like that. And as a result, werewolves and other were creatures cannot regain rage, which I thought was brilliant. It's like, well, hold on, hold the phone. This is interesting. I might even like to find a way to back this into my modern era mage games, because good grief, this is nice. As a World of Darkness fan, I remember reading the first two editions of Werewolf the Apocalypse, and the rate at which werewolves can regain rage and all the things they can do with it makes them, in my opinion, OP, you know, overpowered. It's like you punch the werewolf in the chest. Oh, he's mad. He gets a rage point and he gets an extra action, and he punches you twice and he's so strong that he folds you in half both times. It's like, okay, this is getting a little silly here. But if a mage can just say, hey, look, I'm going to send away these spirits, you can't regain rage, then werewolves are dangerous, certainly. They're not wimps, but they're not as powerful as they were before. And I can just see so many cool, you know, game scenes coming out of this, that this particular spell, it was like, okay, this is awesome. Now, it tells us that there are spirit talkers in the Holy Lands in the Middle East, and they deal with djinn also. But what I want to know is, how does a Middle Eastern spirit talker deal with a djinn differently than a Bettini does? That would have been so cool. Unfortunately, I did not find that in this section. Moving on to the Valdermen, we get a quick recap of the different factions within the Valdermen. And most of this was covered in the core book, but still it's useful, it's handy, it's all in one place for a storyteller. That's useful material. The note I made in our last episode about a Norse tradition of magic for women coming from Freyja is backed up here. They are spirit talkers, which I guess kind of makes sense, so that fits for me. I accept that. Valdemar material in these books, I think, goes too far in calling magic effeminate for men. It was frowned upon for men to use magic to settle feuds with other men or to gain personal advantages over other men in their community. But I don't think there's anything effeminate about learning the wisdom of the gods or using magic to benefit the whole community. I remember reading some of the Icelandic sagas where some guys were trying to beat up these other guys, and one of the guys got his aged mother out of retirement who knew magic and gave him an edge, and everybody, you know, frowned on that. And it's like, okay, yeah, here we have a personal grudge between two men being settled by magic, and that's effeminate and terrible, yes. But when you have a man who can bring you the wisdom of the gods that benefits the whole community, I just don't see anything effeminate about that. I think these Dark Ages mage books, when they talk about the Valdemar, they take this effeminate magic angle. I think they take it a little too strong. There's some nuance there that I think storytellers should introduce. Okay, of chapter two, we get write-ups on the six fellowships. Every one of these sections ends with something called Player's Toolbox, which is supposed to be, I guess, plot hooks or story hooks for how to play characters that are in this fellowship. All six of these Player's Toolbox sections, in my opinion, were so vague and general that I just didn't find them useful. If they had given more specific pointed ideas, I think they could have been a lot more useful for both players and storytellers. So kind of a missed opportunity there. But okay, well, that was quite a chapter. I'm ready to look at chapter three.
Chapter three is entitled Superstitions and Magic, and superstitions is misspelled in the footer. The first section is belief and power. It says that faith and culture are heavily intertwined. In fact, you could say the one is the other. It says that monotheists generally want to be closer with whatever their powerful entity is, while the pagans want a little more distance, as their gods tend to be a little more fickle. Superstitions tend to be highly distant from the belief that birthed them, so they are seemingly nonsensical. We get the idea that you can take advantage of this, but there isn't a lot of information on it. And it mentions specifically that really only the Hermetics and the Bettini seem to be aware that there is kind of like a meta framework on how magic works. I was hoping for some sort of folk magic system, which we even get in Sorcerer's Crusade, and I just don't recall it being here. Like, no, this is five peasants, if they believe real strong and pray at you, have the ability to stop whatever. And I really thought we would get a system for that. We then get a section entitled Magical Community. It leads off with how to make a chantry. They are very expensive and become important, and they are kind of fueled by a mix of fear by locals, plus the fact that if your mages are doing something useful for the people around, that they will be left alone. This may be part of a library or academy, and we get some information on kind of what they look like. This section felt very similar to what we got in Sorcerer's Crusade. So it mentions that the Old Faith tends to have places in the wilderness, the Hermetics tend to have ones tied to learning, the Spirit Talkers want theirs to be really quiet. It's all of them are perpetually slightly hungover, so everything is dark and very, very calm and quiet, and there's a lot of very salty food around. The Valdermen tend to be far from population centers. The Messianic Voices tend to be close to holy places. Bettini ones are clean and geometric. Mixed ones tend to be generic. Not even like a mix of disparate styles that it could be like, ah, oh, look at this kooky person. He's a night owl that likes loud music, while she's an academic who starts every day at 5 a.m. How will they get along? Generically, apparently, there's really nothing interesting to be had there. We then get more information on dates that are important, such as how moon phases can affect magic, as well as holy days. We get associations for the numbers, as well as numerical significances of the astrological cycle. This is good, perfectly fine. In the previous sections, we got information on rotes and what they did. In the second section here, just titled Magic, we get the opposite, which is to say, you want to do this, how do? And it lists it by a whole bunch of pillars. As Adam mentioned earlier, I don't have an intuitive sense of how these things balance because, yeah, some group may be super good at lighting someone's hair on fire at a distance of 1,000 miles, but at the same time, maybe they're like incapable of banishing spirits or something like that. And stuff like that gets real hard to balance. Like, sometimes I think back to the fact that, what is it, the Hemka Sobek aren't allowed to use four different spheres, and then I remember that the last, like, three mage games I've ran, no one had five or more spheres just because we only ran for five or six sessions. Get it. It's hard to do. We get some information that what it means to pick up another fellowship's pillars. The metaphysical thing that doesn't make sense to me is how does that combine with your foundation? So if you are using sensitivity from spirit talkers, but you've learned Corona from the Hermetics, what does that mean? To me, this kind of presages questions of practice. We get a whole bunch of information on, do you really want to make a new pillar? This is something that was also in the core book. So I don't know if this is something that came up a bunch during playtest or not, but we kind of get the basic levels, and these kind of presage what the forms are from Mage the Awakening, that level one is perception and elemental manipulation, elementary manipulation, that level two is basic manipulation and elementary alteration, that level three is advanced manipulation. Basic alteration and elementary creation. Four is advanced alteration and basic creation, and five is advanced creation. That's not really enough for me to work on. I would need a better definition of perception, manipulation, and creation for that to be something I could run with. We then get a section on Curtamane or Curtamen or Curtains in Maine or however you want to pronounce it. And this makes no sense. Why would a Valdorman no Curtamane? Why would a practitioner of the Old Faith or a Messianic voice know it? Like, this depends on there being kind of a unified notion of magic, which we don't get until the Council of the Nine, really. We get the idea that counter magic exists, but it is quite hard, frequently requiring four or five dots in a pillar. So overall, the section had some super great, useful parts when it's like, hey, here's the straight dope. Here's literally how you do a whole bunch of basic magic effects based on the pillars. But at the same time, it would frequently list how every group would do it, which kind of, to me, takes away from the uniqueness of the pillars, because it seems like the answer in a bunch of cases should just be like, you can't do it. Like, that's part of what makes the magic unique at the time. But I can see from a Chronicle point of view, oh no, we all need to get there quickly. We can't have everyone but the Valdorman able to fast travel or something like that, or to quote the Muppets movie, travel via map. But that was chapter three. It was kind of a sign to me that the authors hadn't, that there was kind of a level of polish that it didn't quite get to have yet. What did you think about chapter three, Adam?
Those issues of balance, you know, you want to take two fictional factions and you don't want one to look better than the other, yet the appeal of the pillar system is different people can do different things. It's different magic. So, yeah, an interesting conundrum to try and wrap your hands around. I found the belief and power section takes two pages to tell us savvy mages observe the local beliefs and take advantage of them. And so, I don't know, when two pages can be summed up in one sentence, I wonder how much filler is in there. The chantry section was nice for me because I just like the topic of chantries in general. So as I was reading through this, I it was interesting to me, yet I found myself wanting systems. And it says, hey, if you want systems, go read Rite of Princes. And it's like, okay, but maybe this section should have been lifted out of this book and stuck on the end of that part of Rite of Princes, because it seems like it would belong there. If you're telling me cool things you can do with chantries, then give me the systems so I can do those cool things, or at least guidelines for systems. It's an odd choice for me on the developer's part, but there's optional rules for dates influencing magic. And I found this helpful, especially from my reading of history. Things did take a lot more time in the Middle Ages. It actually makes sense to me that mages would think of some important thing that they need to do and say, okay, we're going to put this off for 3 weeks for this mystically important day. Whereas modern era mages, it's like, look, if we need to do it, then we better do it now, because waiting is just, you know, putting it off, and we're going to have more problems attached to that. But back in the Middle Ages, it's like, look, there's a time for everything. You can't have it now. We have become patient peoples because in this era we have to be. So I appreciated that. Using the art section gives clarifications on pillar magic, making this book valuable for running games. There's a section there in using the art about social situations that can give helpful control for how to use mind type of magic. Because I remember from a few weeks ago when I was reading through the different pillars in the core book for Dark Ages Mage, it seemed like every darn pillar there could do everything you ever wanted to do for mind. And it's like, even though there isn't a mind sphere in Dark Ages Mage, it seems like the mind sphere was like evenly divided up and stuck into every pillar you can think of. And so for me to come to the Grimoire and see this social situation section to sort of give the storyteller a working framework for, look, for mind-related techniques, socially influencing people through pillar magic, this is the good way to approach it. So that was a nice control on the vague descriptions we got in the core book for the pillars. I found it was, like Terry said, it's very interesting to note that curdiman is known to all mages. And, okay, there's a difference between hearing about it and sort of knowing what it is and being able to do it. And so this section of chapter 3 makes it sound like, oh, yeah, all the different fellowships, they can all do curdiman. It's like, well, I thought that was a really hermetic thing. And in 1230, hermetic magic was known to the Order of Hermes. It wasn't typed up in a nice leaflet and handed out to everyone so you can do it, too. That's not what the 1200s was about. So, yeah, I have to side with Terry's criticism that you can't have a Valderman and a Spirit Talker just sort of standing around watching a round of curdiman between two hermetics and say, okay, let me try now. It's like, it's not that simple. So that was kind of odd. Now, I can understand the game developers wanting to have a way for player characters in this setting to settle magical disputes nonviolently. That is a useful thing. That is why curdiman gets written about in so many different editions of Mage. But yeah, I just want to have a reasonable approach to this idea that, hey, you can do it too, even though you not only don't know anything about hermetic magic, but you've heard that it's something to avoid because it's weird and foreign. But yeah, you can do curdiman, totally. Just jump in. When we were going through the core book and the chapter on the pillar of magic system, I said, where's the counter magic? Well, in the grimoire on page 122, here's the counter magic. It's actually right here for us. It talks about how each fellowship would go about using counter magic and how some are a little better at it than others. And it's like, oh, wow. I mean, this alone makes the grimoire a necessary supplement for the Dark Ages Mage book. I mean, it's like, don't play the game without the grimoire because you need the counter magic. I have a strong suspicion that Stephen Michael DePisa actually listened to our podcast on the Dark Ages Mage book. He heard my criticism about there being no counter magic, and then he went back in time and shoved it into the grimoire just before it went to press, making him a very cheeky fellow. I don't know quite how he did that, but hats off to you if that's what would happen. Otherwise, it's just me settling into Twilight. After that really useful counter magic section, we turn to chapter 4.
Chapter 4 is entitled From the Other World and goes over what it specifically refers to as Thaumivores, which I guess we don't really have the term bygone quite yet. And it says there's a bunch of different ways to find them. You can go to where the gauntlet is thin and try and see if they're rummaging around. You can find area where rumors of their feedings have happened, or you can track it by the tacit needs indicated that this is just kind of a mundane thing that they're looking for on this side of the gauntlet. We learned that otherworldly prey are 100% tacit, so that's nice, and certain creatures have the ability to digest different things in different ways, and it gives us the idea that everything contains quintessence, but some things' digestive tracts are much more capable of removing it, that for a dragon it's much easier to take the quintessence out of a virgin than anyone else. Good to know. High bioavailability or something like that. It's like, don't make them too outlandish. That could border on making the Dark Ages interesting, and we don't want that to happen. They are rare among the Bettini and the Messianic voices, with the old faith being most likely to have it. We also learn that Infernalists keep them, but the information we have on Infernalists at this point is pretty thin. And then we get some examples of just kind of entities, which aren't necessarily familiars, but it was kind of implied that they were, like you have the Black Dog at the Crossroads, which can't materialize, so I don't know how good a familiar that would really make. We get more Djinn. Really wish again that we had the Taftani, and the Djinn are listed as being from Mount Kaf. We get Kabir, who lifts stuff, Bulbul, who spies on stuff, and Shams-e-Pisha, who is a lion cat from the Saga comic book series. Aisha Kandisha, who is, I think, someone who would really get along with the Sisters of Hippolyta, and that made no sense unless you've already read the section. So we then get the Dark Ages Grimoire section on the Incubi and the Succubi, and we get the following. A powerful mage, however, can turn the tables and instead draw tasks from the demon by casting an extended spell over the course of a sexual coupling session. The mage rolls only her foundation with no pillar. Ironic in that this is sex. She must withhold her climax until she achieves 5 successes, and after that she can withdraw 1 point of task from the demon, who loses a willpower point and 1 level of health. This creates ambiguity in the phrase, I had a mage session today and nobody came. The next section is on that may not make it into the final episode. We then get information on the Fae, who exist in this era, and this goes on much more information besides just kind of the Fae that we would eventually see in Changeling, and talks about the Seaborn Nuklavi, which is the skinless, half-human, half-horse entity, the Skogra, the Daugr, who eventually become the dwarves. We get their treasures, and these are, again, kind of tied to the Arthurian mythos. And then we get, like, two magic items. We get a dowsing rod that costs willpower. They can find anything within 200 yards. And a brazier of summoning that you only need one dot in your appropriate pillar to summon. This section was fine. I don't know if it was too much or too little. The thing on task processing really made it like this is Dark Ages, the Tassening. And it's like, well, vampire people like, and they have to constantly consume blood. What if we made mages constantly requiring quintessence? Which, if true, fine, but like quint seems largely a thing to make effects permanent. So I don't know if their logic was, well, we've created a generic system that allows you to make magic items. You don't really need magic items here, or they just didn't have enough space for more magic items. Like, this is, again, the tail end of the Mythic Age that maybe just closed. I kind of expected more artifacty, super cool things to be around. I wanted some religious relics or some great hermetic items. We just don't get it. But, I mean, that could just be being a victim of page count. What did you think of Chapter 4 from the other world?
Well, started off with some advice about helping your players curb their more strange requests for familiars, and I totally agree with that. I was running a mage game in modern-day Chicago. I had a player who was pushing me to let him have a familiar that was a full-sized lion that could breathe fire like a dragon and fly through the air. It's like, oh boy. Yeah, you do need to help guide your players towards better choices for familiars, so I totally understood that section. One criticism on the familiar section, though, is it seems to forget that there are many Umbrood who want to live in the physical world. And so that was something that was picked up in many past mage books, but this section seems to just assume that Umbrood want to stay in the Umbra, and so you have to have a hard time pulling them in. So that was kind of a gap for me. Yeah, Terry told you about that amazing and very detailed system of harvesting tasks from a incubus or succubus. You look, if a player came to me and said they wanted a scene where they were going to get some tasks from one of those things, I would just say, no! Doesn't sound like my cup of tea. We'll do a roll for downtime if you really got to do that. But in the game, in a session, nah, I'm good.
I think you mean getting downtime, not downtime.
There are new djinn in this section, which we got djinn in the core book for Dark Ages Mage. But this was very helpful because the djinn that we get here go along with the Solomonic magic that we get in this book. So, you know, from chapter one. So this fits very nicely and is quite helpful. There is an in-character letter from one mage to another about the Fae and how you ought to watch out for those Fae. I thought that was a really poor use of space in the book. I'm not against in-character fiction in these books. I've seen it done very well in some mage books, but this particular letter from one mage to another was just a poor use of space. There are yet again more conflicting statements about what is Cold Iron in this setting. If you want to be a storyteller for Mage Dark Ages, both this book and the core book both have conflicting statements about what is Cold Iron. Is it pure iron that has been worked at a forge in the regular way? Or is it unheated beaten iron? You know, a storyteller is going to have to make a call because that's the only way you're going to be able to run Dark Ages Mage and deal with the Fae NPCs. There are fairy treasures in here, and they are actually repeats from the core book. That was, I think, a poor choice on the part of the authors. Although there is a brazier of summoning. I thought that was a really cool item. That would be fun to pull into games. With that, I believe we are ready to take a look at Chapter 5, and I'm going to help out with the walkthrough on this chapter. It is a chapter for storytellers. It is comprised of two main sections. There's details on Europe in 1230 and how people traveled during that era. For a more in-depth look at current events, the reader is pointed to the book Dark Ages Europe, which I myself have not read. This chapter hits the high notes for five topics. First is the Masasa War. Whenever I hear that name, I think of masala, and I think two Indian restaurants went to war. But no, the Masasa War was when the Order of Hermes discovered House Tremere, betrayed the Order by becoming vampires. The other houses tried to eliminate the Tremere, but found them formidable opponents. The Tremere kept their secrets for over 170 years as they converted or killed their own members. In 1201, the houses of the order cooperated to attack the Tremere, but they could not bring down their stronghold in the Transylvanian mountains, what is today Romania. This chapter tells us the conflict is still active, whereas previous passages in Dark Ages mage books stated hostilities were winding down. Storytellers will need to make their own call. Tremere have established a presence in the city of Vienna, and it has become a dangerous place for all mages after dark. I thought that was a pretty cool little detail to add. The Hermetic Chantry of Mistridge fell to the Craft Masons 20 years ago, as of 1230. The Craft Masons are flushed with victory and moving about the countryside of Europe. They are finding fresh targets for their wrath and telling the common people about the virtues of their beliefs. Next, we turn to Infernalists and Nefandi. Those two terms overlap at times. The term Infernalist sometimes means a non-mage who gains specific powers or knowledge of dark hedge magic from evil beings. Infernalist can also mean a mage who serves dark powers but has not gone through the calls of the Nefandi and thus is not a member of the Nefandi faction. Dark Ages mage appears to define Infernalists as evil non-mages. Nefandi is spelled here with an F and is a cult of mages that seeks to convert other mages into new members of their cult. There is no mention of Nefandic calls. This chapter doesn't make it clear if Nefandi have magic of their own. It focuses on members of the six fellowships who use the magic they know to become Barabi and serve the Nefandi. The text states many hermetics become Barabi while few from the Old Faith Spirit Talkers or Valdermen do. There is no information on locations or specific activities of Infernalists or Nefandi. We're just told they're out there. The Crusades and their aftermath is next. Although the Dark Ages Mage Rulebook talks about Crusade activity in the Holy Lands, here we are told the Crusades are largely over. There are small military expeditions, but they are mostly to Egypt. The cities of Jerusalem, Nazareth, and Bethlehem are controlled by Europeans, but Muslims are allowed to visit. These are places where Messianic and Bettini mages can mix openly and peacefully. Templar mages are also found there. We're told many domains in Western Europe were left in the hands of regents, so some areas see an easing of pressure on Old Faith mages, while some have greater problems with bandits, regular sleeper bandits. We finish our look at Europe with the Spice Road, which isn't really operating yet. Storytellers are told they can take liberties with history and use it to send players on distant journeys. To sum up my thoughts on this overview of the times, I found the Masasa War and Crusades section helpful to storytellers. The other three sections were so sparse, I couldn't find much of value for a storyteller. The second half of the chapter takes a closer look at travel in the 1200s. Most people don't travel, but mages have many reasons to do so. Travel by foot is most common. We get required resources ratings to own a horse or wagon. Compasses and maps are scarce. Even those maps obtained in Europe are usually inaccurate. New faces in every place smaller than a large city are mistrusted. Although fantasy RPGs have accustomed us to inns, there aren't many in 1230. Large cities have them, but outside of that, you're not going to find that many. Homes and monasteries or convents are places to stay for the night, and if you don't make a good impression, forget it. Camping outdoors is common, and we get info on skills to get dinner while avoiding illness. Staying in a cottage or hut for the night is customary in this era, but the cultures of villages varied a great deal. Plus, this is the world of darkness. Vampires are real, so knocking on a door after dark may get a refusal. Specific expectations of both host and guest are listed and quite helpful. A list of possible superstitions pertaining to strangers and peasant homes is a nice addition. Water travel is common, but mostly done in sight of the coast. Paying a fare to travel in someone else's boat is common, but don't expect comfort. Sailors on the larger vessels that travel over salt water are more accepting of foreigners, but have many odd superstitions of their own. Although not as detailed as Sorcerer's Crusade books, we get info on the ships of the time. Most ships have only one level below deck. A sidebar gives guidelines for the kinds of travel people can expect based on their resources level. The final page is spells that can come in useful during travel. Spells for creating fog, summoning storms, and calling wind are given for each fellowship. The spirit talkers have the hardest time of it. They basically talk to the local spirits and try to talk them into cooperating. And if the local spirits are grumpy, well, too bad for you. I thought the travel section was quite useful. Those of us who aren't well-versed in Middle Ages history can skim this section for useful hints on running scenes when the players are far from home. Well, Terry, what are your thoughts on Chapter 5?
The kind of big chronicle idea section seemed like, except for the Masasa War section, kind of, to me an attempt to say, here are plots that can gainfully employ a whole group that every fellowship may want to take a part in. And even in the Misasa War section, it's like, yo, the Hermetics are getting desperate. They're willing to pay anyone to help them do it. I thought it was interesting that they list that in 1022, Tremere turns into a vampire and keeps it secret for 177 years. And the Order of Hermes was less concerned about, like, the diabolism of turning into a vampire and more, hey, how did you keep the secret to us for 177 years? That's a lot of years. That's a surprisingly long time. In 1201, the house is tried in absentia and Wizard's March is declared, which technically is still ongoing, kind of in the same way that's like, World War II never ended. The thing I really don't get about this is like, so boss, yeah? Is that their stronghold? Yep. That thing on the ridge. Yep. Seems really hard to attack. Yeah. What if we had a 12-hour period during the day where neither they nor their gargoyle minions would in any way be able to respond? Because if they did, they would burst spontaneously into flame because of the curse of Cain. Nah, it'll never work. I never got that. Like, you're like, oh no. They're like, it's like, okay, we got House Tremere and their magic. Ooh, okay, well, who's defending it? Additional vampires. Okay, so you're telling me 100% of the people here are useless during the day. Yes. So, I mean, some information then on, oh, here are the things they use to protect it. I would need to go and see what the thaumaturgical paths are to make it impractical and so on. It just kind of makes it hard for me to believe in some of those things. Like when there's a lot in one place, I can see how they can rule a city, especially if you can't ferret them all out. But if it's like House of Tremere and it's literally a house, that I find a little bit harder to deal with. The recommendation to move up the Silk Road I thought was reasonable, to be like, hey, just make this a little bit more of a thing. Again, there was the section on the Mongols where it's like, if you want a historically accurate game, you shouldn't have Mongols in this period. I'm like, if you want a historically accurate game, you shouldn't have wizards. So I feel a little bit more comfortable moving those things. I understand that that's kind of apples and oranges comparison, but really, there's only so much of like I could take. Likewise, when it's like, yep, better play up the paranoia and the sexism or you're doing it wrong, wizard. I like the travel section because this book has clearly indicated to me that in the same way in M20, we have the two additional, in I guess it was second edition, we introduced the sphere of gun, and then later we introduced the sphere of cocaine. I think the appropriate period sphere now is the sphere of horse. So we have the horse rotes, we have the resource levels required to summon a horse, we get indication on how bad wagons are. It really feels like the sphere of horse is the 10th sphere in this era, or I guess the fifth pillar would be the way of saying it. The how to survive section really reinforced that like man versus nature is going to be a ongoing concern if you want this to be accurate, using like Freytag's categorization technique or whatever it is. And it's like, oh yeah, surviving is going to be really hard. And it makes sense why the core book has so many things that are like, this is why this pillar is important. It allows you to get fresh water that will prevent you from like pooping yourself to death. And I'm like, okay, that's more information on the Dark Ages. Still, we don't have enough information like any of the Sorcerer's Crusade books telling us this is how a town is laid out. It gets a little bit rough because like this is maybe an era where rapid progress isn't being made, so maybe the difference between 1230 and 1466 isn't that much, but I would have liked the idea of just like, what does a village hamlet look like? Ah, this is our chantry and it's surrounded by simple country turd farmers or something like that. I don't know, just give me some information on how that rolls. Like, it is very scattershot on what we get details on and what we don't. I thought the hospitality section was pretty neat because it just kind of gave a bulleted list of here are some superstitions that people may follow. And as long as I think you broadcast to the player that these are pretty common superstitions or something like that, I think it is great. So that's what I thought about chapter 5.
I hear you about the Sorcerer's Crusade books gave us like cutaway view of a peasant's cottage and a wealthy merchant's townhouse and a ship and stuff like that. And I think of how so many of the fantasy role-playing games have a map for like everything. It's like, good grief. It's like, yeah, you stop at an inn for a beer and then you leave. Let's give you a detailed two-story map of it. It's like, good grief. We're just stopping for a beer. But anyways, a little bit of that in Dark Ages Mage might have been helpful. It's like, here's a map of Paris in 1230. And you can look at it and go, whoa. That is really different from modern day Paris.
It is four blocks.
Look how, you know, this is over here and that's over there. And I think, you know, just two or three maps, I think, of places in the 1200s would actually be quite helpful for storytellers. I mean, just to guide you into figuring out, oh, this is something I can research online to fill in these gaps that I didn't even know I had before I looked at London in 1230, which, boy, howdy, is that different from London today? That could be quite helpful. But this book finishes up with an appendix. Let's take a brief look at that. The appendix offers us a seventh fellowship, the Craft Masons, who we mentioned in a previous chapter. These are the same Craft Masons from Sorcerer's Crusade, so I'll just offer the interesting bits for our listeners. The first thing on my mind was, what about their pillars? They have the Hermetic pillars, but they gave up Primus, which is power over magical energies, in exchange for Materia, power over inanimate matter. Hermetics of House Verdidius can also learn this pillar. A page is given to the five levels of the new pillar. I think Materia is interesting and different enough from the other pillars to make it compelling. I would be glad to include this in my games. In 1210, the Craft Masons officially left House Ex Miscellanea of the Order of Hermes because their demands to stop the crimes against commoners committed by the Hermetics of Mistridge were ignored. 7 months later, they attacked Mistridge with their newly developed cannons. The text claims a Tremere mage who was a member of the Mistridge Chantry disabled their defenses, but the Tremere's secret was out 11 years before this. Things took time in the Middle Ages, but I think word of the Tremere betrayal would reach France 11 years after it broke. Anyways, after Mistridge fell, the Craft Masons were popular among the peasants of southern France. They gained members and support. This account states the cannons would not have succeeded if not for the defenses being sabotaged from within. The commoners and mages both believed the cannons did it on their own strength. So the paradigm championed by the Craft Masons got a push in its early stages. A sidebar on cannons gives us the pillars needed to make gunpowder, the abilities needed to operate one, plus its range and damage. Dark Ages Mage is one of the very few fantasy role-playing games where your character can invent gunpowder. We learn the Templars and Gabrielites, called the Inner Doctrine in the Dark Ages Mage rulebook, both support the Craft Masons. The Craft Masons have 33 degrees of initiation, the single member, their leader, having achieved the 33rd degree. The lowest 12 degrees have many members. These mages believe the number of members in the degrees should resemble an Egyptian pyramid, so they are allowing many members to progress quickly to match their desired plan. A schism is developing between new mages and longtime members. The newer members have no hermetic training and look down on mystical ideas. Flush with their recent success at Mistridge, Craft Masons are unwilling to establish relations with other fellowships and eager to attack more chantries they believe are oppressing commoners. And when you've got cannons, there's a whole lot of oppression out there. The appendix ends with the herbalism skill. This has advantages over hearth wisdom in two ways. Poisons can be recognized, and the bonus from working within superstitions can be gained when making a potion or elixir. Well, Terry, did you have any thoughts on the appendix?
I did. Aiming a cannon is difficulty 8, and it's an intelligence plus an awareness roll. Intelligence plus awareness, meaning you're like, hey, I can see across the gauntlet. Also, let's shoot these guys in the face. It also mentions that some of the original ones still exist. So yeah, I am glad that in canon, there are cannons that are still around. And if we did it in and around, we could have a canon about canon cannons. And I want that to exist someday. Previous editions talked about how Grimgoth was implied to have brought down the defenses of Mistridge from the inside. And here it's like, nope, this is how he did it. This is a picture of him going, holding a copy of that day's newspaper, pulling the quintessence out of it. There is no ambiguity. I like the section where they talk about how the kind of the difference between the Craft Masons and the Order of Reason. And initially you're like, oh yeah, why wouldn't you want to help the common person? And then it has the passage, magic they insist must be made rational or cannot help the common man. Once the common man can understand it, then it has merit. Nearly every other mage on the planet, however, takes exception to this. If magic had to wait until every commoner can understand it, then the world would never have access to magic and the wonders it provides. Makes sense! Like, a lot of the original things are like, yeah, the Craft Masons, you're like, how could I possibly disagree with that? And they're like, no, they mean everyone. And you're like, oh, that's really going to take a while. But then, ta-ta-da-da-da, you get science. And since everyone understands all aspects of science, obviously the Craft Masons are fine. I thought this was a perfectly good little appendix. Adam, what did you think about the book overall?
Well, let's see. Generally speaking, I think the developer should have kept a tighter control of the content to ensure gameable material in each section rather than just some. I was thrown by the terminology here. I thought that spell meant, you know, an example of pillar magic, and rote meant an example of sphere magic. That's how the core book dealt with the terms. But in this book, we get a rotes section for pillar spells. And so Yeah, I realize that's nitpicking, but I mean, it was just so useful for mage fans to have these clearly defined terms, and they're no longer clearly defined. Although some sections were missed opportunities, this book is a solid and helpful aid to Dark Ages Mage. I highly recommend it for people who want to play Dark Ages Mage. I think the counter magic and the clarifications on pillar magic section in the middle of the book is going to be terribly useful to you. I thought the insistence on messianic mages seeing everything as being satanic is getting a little irritating by now. These guys are so narrow-minded, I wonder how they even get out of bed in the morning. But overall, no, I really do recommend this book. I think it's one you should have if you're serious about the game. So, Terry, what are your thoughts on the book as a whole?
This was a book that is very hard for me to evaluate because the inconsistency from section to section makes me go, do I feel that this section is lacking a piece of information, or do I feel that this section brought some extra stuff to the party? The fact that the fellowships aren't templated consistently in terms of what is included, it really felt like six authors, six fellowships, go run and do what you want. Now, in some cases, this was perfectly fine, like the amount of information I need personally to run the Spirit Talkers is different than what I would need for the Messianic Voices. But likewise, I assume that there's someone else out there where it would be the reverse, where they would need more information on one section and a little bit less on the other. Sorcerer's Crusade worked really hard to put you in the mindset of the period and to give you the logistics and sociological information to run that through. Here, this is more kind of that generic, vague wilderness fantasy that one gets in like a generic dungeon crawl setting, plus a few reminders of what the thought processes were of people that were running around during this time. I still don't think I have a good idea of what would hold a fellowship together. And without that kind of information, I really feel like this is a game that it would have a tendency to fall to farce. I think the contrivance of using the pillars was a pretty interesting one. And there were enough faults in how they were being used where I would look at a rote, or I would look at a spell, or I would look at an effect, or I would look at a glamour, or I would look at whatever the dink the book decided to call a magical thing. And then I would go to the original pillars and I'd be like, how are you getting that? Like, how are you getting from here to there? The systems that were contained within the rotes seem wildly varied. Some were quite imaginative, but I don't know how I would necessarily adjudicate that at the table. It really felt like a second draft of a game. So maybe it's just not for me, which is entirely fine. For people who are interested, if you're curious about other pillars that could be running around at the during the time, Malcolm Shepard actually did a whole bunch of blog posts and put on the White Wolf Forum some information on, like, yeah, this is what the Akashiana pillars would be and what their foundation would be. And that's kind of fascinating. Whenever someone is like, hey, modern mage should use this, I now feel very comfortable saying no, they shouldn't. In a eminently practical way, I do not think the pillar system can support the variety of magical practice and the breadth that you want to do in a way that is balanced. Some of the precursors to what is going to happen later were kind of interesting. I would have liked a little bit more discussion of what the metaphysics at the time could be. I was hoping to get more information than what we ultimately get for Lost Paths about the Kwijet al-Akbar and so on, that in a time where that is more top of mind, how that would be viewed, and we didn't. So this is fine. It fills in some holes in Mage. You can certainly see how it presages some of Mage the Awakening and so on. And on the whole, I think it is fine, and it may just be the case that this is not for me. Given that it is well written, the words next to each other are perfectly fine. It shows a certain degree of craft and elegance there, but the downfall, as Adam said, does feel like it was on the development or the editing side and just having some more consistency between sections and answering the question of, like, really, we got 30 pages of that and 2 pages of this? How did that happen? Maybe this was just part of that rush of revised, where it was just harder to get books out the door. There was more of a pressure to do so. But if that is the case, it sadly came through in the text.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that's something I didn't consider very carefully. Terry put that point very well. A lot of people are going to look at the core rulebook for Dark Ages Mage, and they're going to say, this is the authority. Everything else, all the supplements are supplements. This is the main book. Whereas what I recommend with Dark Ages Mage is you look at Grimoire and say, okay, this is fixes for problems on the magic rules in the core book. And if you approach it from that point of view, you can have an easier time of things. But if you, most people are naturally going to look at the core rule book and say, this is the main authority. And then, you know, supplements are just add-ons. And you know, from that point of view, it's, I think it's going to be harder to run pillar magic for your players. But yeah, after reading through these books, you know, maybe this is personal bias, but I would rather be a storyteller for Sphere System than for the pillar system. I think with the pillar system, there's a lot more involved. And actually, one of my main criticisms is if I want to create a new faction of mages or bring in some wild faction from one of the older mage books into this setting, I've got to make pillars for them and make a foundation for them. And that's more heavy lifting than I really want to do as a storyteller. I don't even know how long these NPCs are going to be in the games. So yeah, it makes it hard from that point of view for me. But yeah, a lot of interesting stuff here. Well, if you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com. With your questions, comments, or feedback, go ahead. Let us hear what you think. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, and other aggregators. If you like the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a review of Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in their searches. You can follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast. We're also on the web at magethepodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes. We have a YouTube channel now where you can find our episodes. There's a link in the show notes, but you can just do a search for on YouTube for Mage the Podcast. You're probably going to find us. I'd be surprised if you didn't. We're also on Mastodon. A link in the show notes will help you with that. This episode was assisted greatly by our executive producers, and we certainly appreciate them. Terry, can you share their names with us?
I would be glad to. I would like to thank Oracle Sean Cowker, Oracle Benjamin Bendelow, Oracle Buck Gregory, Oracle Christopher Phillips, Oracle Josh Hillerup, Oracle Pukaji, Oracle Neil Patterson, Oracle Jay Widener, Oracle McHale, Oracle the Crew of Erebus, Archmaster Andrew Andelstein, Archmaster Brad of the Blue, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsek, Archmaster Guy Conan Stewart, Archmaster Jason Vines, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Patrick Amara, as well as Alex, Alexia, Anders S., Anon, Bedurfi, Birdo, Blaze, Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Chris B., Sindash, Shadis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, David Roy, Derek, Dennis Osborne, I always do that, Eli Levenger, Fragorock, George Laura, Eable, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jay Gatsby, Jeff Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Julian Andes, Lulz and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Poyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Ricardo, Richard Bat Brewster, Robert Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Chambel de Krieger, Stefan Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, William Connolly, William Martin, and Zach Rules. Thank you so much for your support.
Definitely. We really do appreciate that. If you'd like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep producing episodes like this one. You would also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
Remember, a familiar is not supposed to be a zany animal companion like every Disney film produced since The Little Mermaid. Or at least that's what this book says, and because of that, Dark Ages Mage is wrong. Go change reality. Bye.